Could Alcatraz ever open again? We're going to talk to a woman who lived there with her family and is one of the premier experts on the nation's most notorious prison. Her story next on Smarter News. Alcatraz. Just saying the word out loud instantly brings you an image, a place, a movie, a feeling. Alcatraz is notorious because there's truly nothing like it. I was born and raised in San Francisco. I can't even imagine the city without it. It's such a part of the view out towards the Golden Gate and such a part of the city's story.
Alcatraz is, I would say, the ultimate, right? Nobody ever escaped. One person almost got there, but they, as you know the story, they found his clothing rather badly ripped up. And it was a lot of shark bites, a lot of problems. Just represented something strong having to do with law and order. We need law and order in this country. And so we're going to look at it. Some of the people up here are going to be working very hard on that. And we had a little conversation. I think it's going to be very interesting. We'll see if we can bring it back.
The island itself in San Francisco Bay was discovered around the same time of the American Revolution by a Spanish explorer. And the name Alcatraz is believed to come from a Spanish word that roughly translates to seabirds or pelicans, which would make sense given its location. The island became a military site, in fact, the most heavily armed place on the West Coast during the Gold Rush, and then around the time of the Civil War and later became a site to house military prisoners. Military prisoners built Alcatraz, built the actual prison, and that's how it got its name, The Rock. That's how that reference came about. It became a federal prison less than 100 years ago in 1933, but only lasted about 30 years, a short period of time. It's during that period of time, though, that we get the legend and lore of the prison. And we also come to understand that families had to live on Alcatraz. And our next guest, Jolene Babiak, was one of the children who lived there full time with her family. I guess, Jolene, let's just start with some of the most obvious questions, because I'm sure when you start a conversation and you say, oh, well, you know, one time I lived on Alcatraz, it's not like a normal thing that, you know, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
Well, I don't do that.
Yeah.
I do not do that.
Okay. How did your family wind up living on Alcatraz?
Okay. So, you know, my father graduated from college in 1933, the big, you know, horrible year of the Great Depression. And, you know, he had a series of part-time jobs up until 1938. And by then they had two children, my older brother and sister, and he needed a full-time job. So he was forced into the job by the Depression. And I think he thought he was going to ride out the decade, but World War II hit. And so he joined the military. Well, when you're in the military, you're actually accumulating promotions that you can apply to your government job. So he literally came back in 1946, 47. And then we were transferred to Terre Haute, Indiana, and they wanted to go to the West Coast. And so he applied to be transferred, never thinking that he would go to Alcatraz. And boom, he came out here. He was transferred in 1954, and as shocked as anybody else.
Do you remember your first day? Did you go with suitcases? Did you have moving boxes? How did you even think about living on the island? It wouldn't even dawn on me, quite frankly, Jolene, that families live there.
Alcatraz was unique. It was an island. So all the apartments were furnished. They didn't want people bringing on, taking off furniture. So all the apartments were furnished and you just moved in and you brought your personal things, you know, or towels and sheets and things like that. But I don't remember my first day. I do remember being there, you know, we were living in a small town. My dad had already gone to the island. And my mother needed to sell the house. So we stayed behind while that happened. And then we came out in April of 1954. And, you know, I mean, sure, I think she probably told me that it was a prison, it was where Dad worked, but she probably accentuated the fact that there were 60 families on the island and there were 75 children. And I was going to get on a boat every day and go to school in San Francisco. So this is my perspective. It was like, oh yeah, let's go. Going from Terre Haute, Indiana to San Francisco was like going from the Kansas farm for Dorothy to the Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz. I mean, San Francisco was this glorious cosmopolitan sort of world-class city with hotels and, you know, cabs and, you know, big skyscrapers. And it was beautiful. And we were living on an island overlooking that city. It was magnificent.
I have to confirm, I am a little biased as a native San Franciscan myself, but it is a beautiful city. And when you go many places around the world, you realize, wow, America has some beautiful cities. San Francisco is one of them. And especially from that perspective, the middle of the bay, looking back at it,
yeah,
it must have been just spectacular. What was daily life like on Alcatraz?
Well, you know, during the school year, we got up pretty early in the morning, got on the boat. I think the boat that I took was probably the 7:20 a.m. boat. And we traveled with other kids, and you would walk up the hill to a bus and get on a bus and go a mile to, I went to St. Bridget's in those days in the second grade. And so I had my little sailor, you know, uniform. So we would walk down the hill, which was about a mile. And as we walked down, we collected more kids, and there were usually five or six of us. In the summertime, you just went out on the big old army parade ground and played with whoever was there.
What was your father's role?
He eventually became the superintendent of industries, which the director of industries. Industries was where about 100 prisoners worked and made products for the government, like military clothing or gloves for other institutions or things like that. They did the laundry for the military, and they actually earned money in that job. So my father was able to gather the better prisoners, the more stable prisoners. So he was director of industries, and then he became the associate warden, which was a highly controversial at that time switch from superintendent of industries to associate warden. Associate warden's head of custody, in essence. He's the guy you go to when you get in trouble, and, you know, either whether you're a guard or a prisoner. And industries was more about rehabilitation. So it was kind of a controversial switch for him. That's why we lived on the island twice. The first time, because we just moved to San Francisco, and we had to get settled, and we lived on the island, and then we moved off. And then when I was 15, we came back because his job as associate warden required that we live there.
Were you excited to go back?
Yeah, it was totally
cool.
Yeah, people loved living on Alcatraz. I can name three or four families that lived there for 20 years. The rent was cheap. You got all the utilities were paid. You had a beautiful $1 million view. I mean, today it would be a $4 million view.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about a couple of things, a couple of questions that come up here. One is, when parents sometimes come home from work, they may talk about their day and, you know, what they experienced. What did your father share with you about what it was like to be around the prisoners? Do any stories stand out to you?
You know, he was part of that World War II generation that didn't talk. I'm sure he told my mother things when they were alone, you know, late at night or whatever, but we didn't talk about the prison. And when he did talk about it, he told the funnier stories. In fact, there was a murder in the industries in the late 50s, and I didn't know for 20 years that he'd been, you know, kind of involved in it. He had to investigate, you know, the actual incident. I had no idea.
And where were the prisoners?
Well, they were on the opposite side of the island. The island was set up, by the time I got there, the apartments that had been up here were all moved down to the parade ground area. And it's a big, you can see it in all the photographs. It's a big, flat, paved, you know, it's called the parade ground. We called it the playground. And there are apartments that ring around the parade ground. And so the prisoners were on the opposite side of the island. They escaped in that direction. They never came down to our area to escape, largely because they couldn't really see our area. They knew we were there, but they couldn't really see it. So, you know, I always joke that it was a low crime neighborhood.
And when you, just to be clear, because I am going to ask you about escape from Alcatraz, when you say prisoners escape, are you talking about them actually trying to escape from the other part of the island, or just escape and have a moment of like reflection during some outside time? Like, I'm like, just to be clear, what do you mean jumping off and swimming?
Well, there was one escape where a couple of guys jumped in the water. One of them turned around and came back.
It's pretty rough out there.
He was the smart one. No, they usually were fairly well planned. I mean, sometimes they were planned. Sometimes they were stupidly planned. One guy got a bunch of tin cans, and he somehow thought that these tin cans were gonna, you know, were gonna help him float. And he got caught, and he got taken up to the cell house with all these tin cans, you know, clanging off of his waist. You know, there were various attempts over the years, and that was the interesting thing, is because over the years they learned all the bad ideas, and they would glom onto the better concepts.
You are the person to ask about it, Jolene. Has anyone actually escaped Alcatraz? Did anyone actually do it? So I'm asking a primary source on this.
So I'm going to start with the tides. The tides are going from Silicon Valley in the South Bay to Hawaii. Silicon Valley, Hawaii, every 6 hours, you know, they're going one way or the other. So that's a problem for escaping from Alcatraz. You really can't get to the city easily. You're going to be swept to the South Bay and you won't make it, or to Hawaii and you won't make it. There were two men who made it off the island, but they were brought back within about 12 hours. The first guy, John Giles, put together an army uniform during the World War II. Alcatraz used to do the military laundering of all the bases. So that would come over in big bins, and he was squirreling away little pieces of uniform. Took him years, apparently. And at the same token, there was another army boat that would come from Angel Island, which was an army fort and a base, would come over to Alcatraz, pick up the Alcatraz kids, and then go to San Francisco. So it made this triangle of routes. So when this boat comes over, the Frank M. Coxey, he sneaks, he's a dock worker, and he sneaks below the dock and picks up his uniform, puts his uniform on, and walks on the boat.
Sounds like a good plan.
But he made two mistakes. I love this story. It didn't take a genius to see that there were only five guys on the dock and not six. And the boat had just left. And also, he thought the boat was going to San Francisco, and he could have conceivably made it and disappeared, but the boat was going back to Angel Island. So as soon as he went missing, the officers got aboard another boat and met him over there. And he was quite surprised to see them, you know. And so everybody liked that escape. They brought him back. They took his picture. And, you know,
were you there at the time, Jolene? Like, do you remember, were you ever awoken by, thinking the movies, like the big lights, you know, and the sirens of someone worried about being escaped? Did that ever happen when you were there?
Yeah, 1962, the big Clint Eastwood escape. I was there when that happened. The siren woke me up.
No kidding.
Kind of fun.
Exciting. And so did that lead to an actual escape in 1962?
The second part of my story, or, you know, is that two men made it to shore but were brought back. Five men disappeared, and three of them were that escape, the 1962. Clint Eastwood escape from Alcatraz is the depiction of that escape. Two made it to shore and were brought back. They're not among the five that disappeared.
Two
in 1936 and three in 1962 disappeared. Sadly, when you escape, when you're a man like that and you escape, you take that behavior with you and you tend to get noticeable. And I always like to say, stealing a car is initially a good idea, but cars run out of gas. And now you have a second problem. You have to get another car or you have to get gas. And that causes attention. And it's also a trail. So the fact that there was no trace on land, no evidence on land, is not a good sign for these guys. It probably means they drowned because they probably would have been picked up.
Interesting.
It's always the best pill in the room, but
no, I mean, this is the great question of Alcatraz and the lore of Alcatraz. Did anyone actually survive and turn their life around to the point that they're no longer in trouble? You know, it's escape and redemption story that seems unbelievable, but
yeah,
you know, leads to conversations like this.
Men paroled out and turned their lives around, you know, so, I mean, people got out in legal ways and live to tell. And I've met many of them, or not many, but I've met about 25 prisoners, and most of those never went back to prison. But those are people with insight. Those are people that can look at the course of their life and go, wow, you know, I've only myself to blame. And a lot of prisoners don't have insight. It's part of their personality disorder, or it's part of their mental illness. They don't really know themselves. And so when you don't know yourself, it's difficult to change your behavior.
So the other part I'm thinking about is the fact that there was no water, you know, fresh water on the island, and sewage, you know, this idea of a sewage system was an issue and is one of the big questions when we think about, and we'll talk a little bit about that, the potential to ever reopen Alcatraz. You do have some of these just basic questions of how do you get these things. Was that a factor for you living there? Sewage, fresh water, that sort of thing? Did they have that all worked out? I'm just thinking about your mom with a bunch of kids on Alcatraz trying to make it all work, you know, do the laundry, cook the dinner, do all the things that she needed to do. My heart's going out to her at this point. So what about that part of it?
Well, I think groceries was tough on them. And I think that people usually after years would get tired of bringing over their groceries on the boat. And having to make, you know, having to adhere to the boat's schedule, because the boat was frequently throughout the day, but anything you brought over on the island, and you go shopping in the city and bring over a Simplicity pattern, you know, which, you know, my mother and I would go look at McCall's and Simplicity patterns and ride the cable car and go to Woolworths and have a chocolate Coke, you know, that was our big deal. But anything you bought, you had to drag back on the boat. So I think that was tiresome. Water was barged over, came from the same reservoir that San Francisco got their water, the Hetch Hetchy. And the sewage was dumped in the bay. I mean, unceremoniously, there was a big pipe down at the shoreline, and that sewage was constantly going in the bay. And we weren't unique. All of the sewage went into the bay and all over, you know, all the cities surrounding the San Francisco Bay, all of the sewage was dumped. And that was going to be a problem. That was, I've seen a memo where late in the 50s or early 60s in which someone said, you know, this is going to become a problem. We can see in the future that Alcatraz will effectively be closed because of this.
Do you have one of those, like a core memory when you think back on your time there growing up? And then I want to talk to you a little bit about your work as a historian now, that stands out to you, an experience that comes to mind when you think about your time spent there as a child or as a teenager?
Well, you know, I got my first kiss there, so that stands out.
I mean, how many people can say that, Jolene? Guess what?
You'd be surprised.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't pass judgment. You're right.
There was one of my favorite stories, which you probably can't print, but there was a guy there they called Icebox Annie. I think it was Jimmy Lucas was his real name, and he was from Texas. And, you know, he was a really bad guy. But they used to call him Icebox Annie, and we knew the name, you know, but none of us knew why he was called that. I didn't know for many years. It was because he was caught naked with another prisoner in a walk-in refrigerator.
Well, that'll earn you a nickname. Well, as you point out, lots of eccentric things can happen, well, all over the world, and perhaps more particularly on Alcatraz. How did you go from, oh, this was part of my childhood and my life growing up, to, wait a minute, I'm actually really interested in researching the history here? How did you become an expert on Alcatraz?
You know, sad story in a way. I got fired from a job.
So did I, Jolene. And that's how I ended up a journalist. And here I am. I was part of a massive layoff. Maybe we should count our blessings. We could be in a job that we didn't necessarily, weren't called for. This,
you know,
so tell me. What happened?
It always works out, right? And so I went home and I cried. And then my father had handed me a manuscript that he had written. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to read that now that I have time. And I read his manuscript and I thought, sadly, because I was in my 20s and, you know, you're pretty self-centered at that point in your life. And I thought, you know, I could do a better job than this. And so I pretty much announced that I was going to write a book on Alcatraz. And my father was at the end of his life, and he accepted that rather graciously, I thought, you know, because when I started, I knew nothing. I literally knew nothing. And because I'd never asked and I didn't care and I wasn't interested. And slowly but surely, I began to realize, like we all do, that all stories are more nuanced than are presented in the media or presented in the movies, or, you know, that escape stories have a progression. They have a movement. It's not just one mistake. It's multiple mistakes over the course of an event that causes a breakdown, right? I will say that the most stark thing that I have really come to know is the high number of mentally ill prisoners that are incarcerated. And I think that's shocking. There were men with acute schizophrenia who stayed on Alcatraz for 8 or 10 years. And it's incredibly sad. They were in many cases violent, and so they couldn't be placed anywhere else. But it's really sad when you find out that a man spends 30, 40, 50, or even 60 years in prison with schizophrenia. You know, and after they're paroled, I mean, not all of this is prison, but after they're paroled, then they go to the mental hospitals and they stay there. And in one case, a man was blind, wheelchair bound. He hadn't had a letter from his family in 20 years. I mean, he was completely forgotten, and he died in Springfield after being imprisoned for like 30 years. So I think that's incredibly sad and, you know, an incredibly complex problem that we can't seem to solve.
Who were the Alcatraz prisoners?
They were the worst behaved. I always think of Alcatraz as the top of the pyramid. It was the smallest institution in the system. It housed literally 1% of the federal prison population. Okay, so federal, you know, like, for example, men who've committed crimes against women and children, those are state crimes. Federal is bank robbery, kidnapping, crossing state lines with stolen goods, income tax evasion for the big time gangsters or drug dealers today, you know, so crossing state lines to avoid arrest, anything to do with, you know, Timothy McVeigh bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City, federal crime. So, you know, but mostly it's interstate. So Martha Stewart lied to a federal agent. She went to a minimum level one prison, well, not even a prison, institution. If Martha had messed up, they would have moved her up to a level two. If somebody came in with bank robbery, guns, you know, escapes, prison history, a little bit of violence, they're going to start at a level three or a level four. Leavenworth and Atlanta institutions were level fives. Alcatraz was the level six. It was the only one. So the important thing here is that men did not come to Alcatraz for their crimes. They came there for their behavior.
So it wasn't about the horrificness necessarily of the crime committed. It was the way that they behaved once they were in another prison that then would, yeah, quote unquote, earn them a spot to Alcatraz, which is, yes, how that Alcatraz gets that reputation,
yes,
for housing the worst of the worst.
Yes. And none of this did I know as a kid. And also what this means is mentally ill, because they usually act out in the courtroom. And that gives them a worse, longer sentence. And then they get to prison, they act out. And sometimes they're, you know, erratic. And so they get moved up the system until they're finally on Alcatraz.
Obviously, some of the more famous names of Alcatraz include Al Capone. Does the fame around him match his story at Alcatraz? Is it as interesting as it sounds, or is it just the fact that he was there that is the story?
Well, you know, Capone had neurosyphilis, and about 10% of the people who had syphilis in those days would who would become, would have neurosyphilis, where the disease would actually go to the brain. You know, it's a disease that travels through your body for about 20 years and it goes into the heart or the lungs or, you know, different places. Maybe you go blind or whatever, but in his case, it went to the brain. And so he became kind of euphoric at the end. At one point, he forgot where his cell was and they corrected him and he flew into a rage that ended in a seizure. And so they carried him up to the hospital on a gurney, and he stayed up there for his last year, year and a half, making and unmaking his bed and being euphoric about employing everybody and getting out of prison. And, you know, it's a lot like early Alzheimer's, and eventually it destroys the brain. And he died, you know, when he was, I think, 48. So he died relatively young. So his life was interesting on Alcatraz, but not in the way that it had been before. You know, the peak of his career was when he was about 32, 35. And after that, it was all downhill.
And how did he wind up there?
You know, fame can get you the top prison. That's another way that you can get there. Yeah.
It's a good way to put it, Jolene. Yeah, you're like, but I mean, well known has benefits and it has negatives.
If you kill your husband, you know, you might not go to the top prison, but if you start having a name like Killer Susan or, you know, yeah. Machine Gun Marie, I mean, you know, it's going to work against you.
That's interesting. Yeah. Do you think Alcatraz was effective as a prison?
Oh. Well, that's a complex question. It was probably effective for some people because going there would be shocking to people. You're going over on a boat. It could be a rough ride. You know, then you know the reputation of the prison and, you know, you're stuck in this little, very routine, you know, boring, disciplined island, cold, you know, it's not, mm-hmm. Most people don't live in San Francisco and Alcatraz was cold and you're stuck there for years. And so it could cause you to think about your situation. And at the same time, you're getting older and, you know, you're starting to realize that, you know, maybe life hasn't been so great and, you know, you haven't done the right thing. And as my dad used to say, age rehabilitates. So for those people, yes, it was very effective. Some people who continued to escape and continued to cause problems, or the people who were mentally ill and were not getting treatment, it was not effective. So mm-hmm. It really depended on who you were as a person.
Well, this conversation is making me think many things about the prison system, about mental illness, about the use of Alcatraz. And that's really why I reached out to you. There's been a question about whether or not Alcatraz could ever operate as a prison again. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, again, I come back to water and sewage. Nowadays, the ticket price pays for those kinds of things. The water still has to be brought out. The sewage has to be taken off. And so the ticket prices are high in part. Because
you mean the prices that we actually, when you're saying ticket prices, the actual prices people are paying to go on a tour there.
Exactly. Yeah. A part of it is the maintenance of the docks, the staff, of course, the rehabilitation of the island, which is constantly under repair, and water and sewage that has to be brought over or taken off. So if you were to build a prison there or any kind of facility, those would be the two biggest problems, water and sewage. The other thing is that historically and worldwide, island prisons are not, they're super expensive because of usually water and sewage and everything has to be brought out. And so they're not, I mean, they've all closed. I don't think there are any island prisons that are still in operation. Robben Island in South Africa, Spike Island in Ireland, Devil's Island, of course, and Elba and St. Helena, they've all closed. Alcatraz, McNeil Island in Washington used to be a federal prison and then a state prison. It's now closed. Island prisons are not efficacious. They're expensive and to operate and there's specific problems. So I doubt that the Bureau of Prisons, they're going to look at it, of course, but I doubt that they're going to imagine that they could rebuild the island. And
would they have to do that, Jolene? Are any of the buildings usable? Can they be renovated or rehabilitated for use?
Sure, yeah, but you're talking salt sea air. And the biggest problem is that concrete has rebar and I-beams on the inside. And when there's a crack in the concrete, the moisture gets inside because there's wind, you know, coming from the Pacific Ocean and slamming into that building. And so the cracks appear and then the moisture starts rusting out the metal inside. So you're talking about infrastructure that is crumbling from the inside. So, and that's always going to be a problem there. And nowadays, I mean, well, it's a good, it's an intriguing idea. It's not really a practical idea.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about all those different dynamics, because what feels, there can almost be like an instant emotional reaction to that because of all that we've heard about Alcatraz over the years, but then really thinking about, well, how would that be done and what would that look like and who are we talking about? It does spark interesting conversation and an opportunity to look back. And actually that's where I'd like to end, because before we got started in our interview, it's been so nice to get to know you a little bit. You mentioned viewing Alcatraz as part of a constellation, and that's really going to sit with me, Jolene. And I'd love that for you to share that with our audience, how to view Alcatraz as part of a bigger story for us all to consider.
Yeah, and I think informally it probably started with Alcatraz. No one knew the island was going to be this popular, you know, that it was going to become swell to 5,000 people a day, that sometimes people come back there 2 and 3 times because they learn new things each time. But it is a part of a group of museums and sites, which are kind of loosely regarded as sites of conscience. It's like Dachau in Germany, Robben Island in South Africa. There's the Tenement Museum in New York. You know, there's the Holocaust Museum. There are a number of slavery installations in the South. There are other prisons now that have opened for the public to see. Sing Sing, I think, is open. And these are not necessarily tourist sites. And in fact, I don't like to use that. They're sites of conscience. Of course, tourism is part of the deal, but really people come away with very thoughtful ideas about, I mean, I hear them when I walk down the hill behind them or, you know, to get on the boat and go home. And they're talking about Machine Gun Kelly and what was his problems. And, you know, of course they're talking about Al Capone, but they're also talking about criminal justice and whether there were innocent people put in a prison like Alcatraz. And their comments and questions are very thoughtful. So I think of it as a site of conscience.
What does it feel like to go back every time you return?
To me, it's an educational facility. I like going back because I know the kinds of questions that people are going to ask, and they remind me of different anecdotes. And so it keeps me kind of juiced, you know, about the history. And I like to try to change people's opinions. Sometimes they come out there and they go, I think this place is horrible. And I'll try to present an idea that, you know, the food was good for prisoners. You know, they were safe. They were in a single cell, single man cell. There's not a prison in the United States, you know, that has that, except for those supermax pens, where it's one man, one cell. That's a luxury apartment compared to most prisons. There were guys that left Alcatraz and went to an 8-man cell down in Atlanta. If you can just imagine what that would be like. So it was safer, you know, in a way. So I like to change people's opinions about the island, no matter what they come with.
Yeah, well, I would love the opportunity. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you think we could visit with you, Jolene? Who do we have? I might have to come with you one day to Alcatraz. Who do we have to call?
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to call that person.
Yes, you have to come on an early boat.
Yeah. Well done. That gives us something to look forward to. Jolene, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us.
You're welcome. You're a great interviewer. It was a lot of fun.
Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries. Hey, neighbors, want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.